calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It's the Tom Hartman radio program broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, streaming around the planet as well on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and, of course, AirAmericaRadio.com. Our quote for the day from Thomas Alva Edison, "Restlessness and discontent are the first necessities of progress." Yeah. And speaking of progress and the first necessities of progress, trade seems to be at the core of an awful lot of progress, American progress. And Senator Byron Dorgan, the senator from the great state of North Dakota, is with us. He has a new book out. It's called Take This Job and Ship It. Senator Dorgan, welcome to the program.
How are you today?
I am great. Great to have you with us on the program. Hope you're well.
I am. Thank you.
It is rare that I read writing of American politicians, particularly at the level of the United States Senate, that is as candid and blunt as you are in this book, from how we helped finance September 11, going right after George Bush, to the arc of the book, of outsourcing our jobs and the destruction of the American middle class. I want to congratulate you on that. Can you give us our listeners just a quick thumbnail sketch of the premise of Take This Job and Ship It?
Well, the premise is that we spent a century in this country building something pretty unique in the world. We built a middle class with good jobs that paid well, with health care, retirement. And as we did all of that, we established the rules, the right to organize, right to work in a safe workplace, labor laws, minimum wages, and so on. Now what we have is a new corporate structure identified by those that want to produce in China, move American jobs to China or Sri Lanka or Bangladesh, produce for 20 or 30 cents an hour, sell their products back in the United States, run their income through the Cayman Islands to avoid paying taxes, and those jobs that are left, they want to have them compete with labor they bring through the back door, cheap labor. And I just think that's a construct that's going to dramatically change the fortunes of this country and the people who work in this country.
Well said. And throughout the book, you document how this is happening, how it's come about, and perhaps most interestingly, toward the end of the book, page 242, you have an 11-step program for solving the problem. One of the things that I didn't see in the book and in reading through it, or at least didn't see, profiled with any regularity, was the whole idea of tariffs. In fact, I only saw the word mentioned once on page 52. Tariffs, if you go back to 1787, when Tench Coxe, the American businessman, he was never a politician, who first lobbied for the first American tariff laws, and the first American tariff law said right in it, for the protection of American business. Mm-hmm. The idea was, if there's a dollar's worth of labor in a pair of shoes made in the United States, and a similar pair of shoes made in Malaysia would have 10 cents worth of labor, we can't stop people from importing them from Malaysia, but we can say it's going to cost you 90 cents when you bring them across the border, so that we're equalizing the cost of the labor. And in some cases, the cost of materials when it had to do with strategic things. So that way we were able to say we want to defend these particular industries. Why did you step back from tariffs in this book?
Well, first of all, we have a right to levy tariffs, even under GATT and the WTO, to protect ourselves against what's happening. We have a $700 billion trade deficit right now. $2 billion a day. That means we're selling part of America each and every day, $2 billion worth, to foreigners. It's unbelievable what's happening. We have a right to levy tariffs. Actually, the recommendations in the book, one of which comes originally from Warren Buffett in a Fortune magazine article, talks about import certificates, which is another way of imposing tariffs, in effect. But the major point of my book is to say, this can't continue. Because I tell stories about Huffy bicycles or the dancing grapes from Fruit of the Loom or, Move to China or Fig Newton cookies are Mexican. I don't know whether you know that. And a whole series of stories about Levi's. The Levi's, there's not
one pair of
Levi's.
They closed their last factory a couple of years ago.
Yeah, not one pair of Levi's is made by Levi's anymore, none in America. And so I've told stories about what has happened to American workers, because they are told now that their competition is a billion and a half people around the rest of the world that will work for 30 $0.30 an hour, and you can put in prison if they try to organize, and no health care. I'm just saying that, in my judgment, that is going to shrink the middle class in this country, injure our future economic opportunities, and somebody needs to talk about it, and I decided, I'm going to write a book about it. And one final point, if I might, we actually have an insidious, perverse tax break that says to a company, fire your workers, close your American plant, move them all to China, and we'll give you a tax cut. That is unbelievable, and I've offered four amendments in the Congress to shut that tax break down and can't get it done.
We're talking to Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota, and his new book, Take This Job and Ship It, the subtitle, How Corporate Greed and Brain-Dead Politics Are Selling Out America. And it's just, this is an absolutely brilliant piece of work that you have done, sir. Absolutely brilliant. As you read through the book, you get this kind of progressive sense of almost despair at story after story of this happening, mm-hmm. that there has been a transfer of sovereignty in a very real way. I mean, I remember back in the 60s when Barry Goldwater would go on, and his heirs still are, about how the United Nations was an evil because we were, giving up our sovereign right to declare war on another nation by signing the treaties that in part we signed to get into the United Nations. And yet our international trade agreements, many of them are not treaties, but some of them are, or components of them are, have surrendered the sovereignty of the United States not to other nation states, but to multinational corporations.
Absolutely.
This seems like it would be the kind of thing that would be the first, level of hysteria coming out of the right wing, for example, given, their years and years of opposition to the United Nations. Why are they not, why is it that Democrats are talking about this and not everybody?
I wish I knew. There's this dead silence about it. And, it's interesting. In some areas, the right wing has grabbed language and misused it or captured it. They've turned liberal into a dirty word, as you know, over a couple of decades. But the issue of protection, they want you to feel embarrassed that you somehow want to protect the economic interests of our country. One person said to me, well, this is economic nationalism. I said, well, God forbid that we should be interested in what happens in our country. I'm not for putting walls around our country. We should compete. We should trade. I'm for robust trade. But I damn well demand that the trade be fair. And when it's not fair, this country needs to have a backbone to stand up for its interests.
One of the things that I most appreciated in your book was you started right out your flat world, no flat wrong, by saying Tom Friedman says the world is flat. What? Or words to that effect. Tom Friedman, his Olive and Lexus Tree book and now his World is Flat has been the main cheerleader for free trade. How do you take that on with your colleagues? How do you wake them up from the days of this?
Well, I've written a book. If I can't pass an amendment because I don't have the votes, I'll write a book. I like Tom Friedman. He's a brilliant writer, Pulitzer Prize winner. I introduced him to my colleagues once when I invited him to speak to our caucus, as saying he's not always right, but he's never in doubt.
Yeah.
He looks at Bangalore with rose-colored glasses and says, isn't this wonderful that we can ship all these jobs? Well, it's not so wonderful if what this means is we're pushing Americans down rather than pulling others up, and that's exactly what's happening with wages, with jobs, with health care and retirement benefits.
Senator Dorgan, given that the Republicans are so solidly as a block in favor of this corporate so-called free trade, the multinational corporate sovereignty over the United States, do you think it would be safe to say that basically this is just a matter of who's been bought by whom?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, sure, there's a lot of that influence.
There are a few Democrats out there, too.
And I mentioned there's some Democrats. I mean, this is, some of this has happened on the Clinton watch, NAFTA, for example.
Yep.
Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, Republican, is very strong in terms of the kinds of things that I'm talking about. I've worked with him on these issues.
Mm-hmm.
But, I just think we have to change course because I don't think what's happening today works for the future of this country. And, the American people are being shortchanged, our farmers are being shortchanged, and somehow we have to wake up. You can't have $2 billion a day going out in terms of our currency to other countries to purchase part of America. We're consuming 6% more than we're producing. That doesn't last very long.
Well, on the flip side of that I think most Americans don't realize, is that if you have $2 billion a day going out of this country in terms of the trade deficit, that means that other countries, people from other countries, have to buy $2 billion
Absolutely.
Worth of America. They're buying our businesses, our land, our buildings, and they are going to own them, and they're going to take the profits from them home.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, the other thing is the big box retailers forcing people to produce in China so they can put cheap products on their shelves, and that benefits consumers, and yes, it does, but what's the price of being able to buy a gallon of mustard or a 12-pack of underwear that's produced by people that are making pennies an hour? You know, there's a huge price for that, and I just hope that we can turn inward a little bit to say, all right, here's what we created, here's why we created it, it was a marvel in the entire world, and we want to preserve it to the extent we can in this country, dealing with our standard of living and opportunities and hope for the future.
Well said. You've got to buy this book. I have to say this to my listeners. You've got to buy and read this, and read it. It's called Take This Job and Shove It, How Corporate Greed and Braindead Politics Are Selling Out America by Senator Byron Dorgan. Senator Dorgan, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks a lot. Good to
great having you on, and keep up the great work. 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann radio program, The Real Free Speech Zone. We'll be back with your calls and more right after the break.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left, took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more.
Or take this job and ship it, as Byron Dorgan would say. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. Time, I think, to look back a little bit. The Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, which is used to be the intelligence apparatus of the United States. It was converted into the CIA in, as I recall, either the late 40s or early 1950s, right after World War II. But during World War II, it was referred to as the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. And the OSS put together a profile of Adolf Hitler. Now, you say, why are we talking about Hitler? Because of a new Harris poll. And I will get to that in a minute. But let me just, you know, put that seed down. There's a new Harris poll out about what Americans believe about Iraq. And it's startling. So back to Hitler. Here was Hitler's psychological profile, as prepared during World War II by the USOSS. I'm quoting now. His primary rules were never allow the public to cool off, never admit a fault or wrong, never concede that there may be some good in your enemy, never leave room for alternatives, never accept blame, concentrate on one enemy at a time and blame him for everything that goes wrong. People will believe a big lie sooner than a little one. And if you repeat it frequently enough, people will sooner or later believe it. This is from page 51 of an OSS report that was put together back in 1940, right, it must have been 1941, about Adolf Hitler. Sound familiar? The Harris survey, it sounds like Rick Santorum's efforts have borne some fruit. Santorum running around, along with Pete Hoekstra from Michigan, running around going, we found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq! Talking, and it wasn't even a cache, it wasn't even a stash of them. It was, here and there, over the course of the last couple of years, we'll find, here's one old shell from the 1980s that we sold to Iraq, that the Reagan administration or the Bush senior administration sold to Saddam Hussein, that used to have mustard gas, and it's all degraded now. And an aggregate, one here, two there, one, never more than three, pretty much all over the country, we've found a couple hundred of these things. And so Santorum and Hoekstra call this press conference and say, we've found weapons of mass destruction. Yes, indeed. And apparently the big lie to quote Adolf Hitler from Mein Kampf, in the big lie there is always a certain force of credibility. Apparently the big lie is paying off for the Bush administration. This from the new Harris poll. Despite being widely reported in the media that the U.S. and other countries have not found any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, surprisingly, more U.S. adults, 50%, think that Iraq had such weapons when the U.S. invaded Iraq. This is an increase from 35% in February of 2005. In other words, 14% more people now think that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction than when we invaded than did back a year and a half ago. How could that happen? It could only happen because the purveyors of the big lie are out there. Not only that, I mean, you take it a step farther. 72% of Americans believe that Iraqis are now better off than under Saddam Hussein. Ask an Iraqi about that, and you will get a slightly different story. For example, this morning, the Speaker of the House of Iraq, as al-Maliki is meeting with George W. Bush, the Prime Minister, the Speaker of the House, the Iraq equivalent of John Boehner, the Iraq equivalent of Newt Gingrich, the Iraq equivalent of Tom DeLay, the Speaker of the House, or the Speaker of the Parliament, of the Iraqi Parliament, who last weekend had described the U.S. occupation of Iraq as butcher's work, which caused Josh Bolton, you know, the guy with the pictures of Bush's hands all over his office, the hand fetishist, caused Josh Bolton to go on national TV over the weekend and go, oh, no. He really didn't mean that. He has an appreciation for the sacrifice so many Americans have made. Well, he held a news conference today. And he said, and I quote, I personally think whoever kills an American soldier in defense of his country, this would be Iraq, would have a statue built for him in that country. He also said that we're trying to control the oil fields in southern Iraq. Why? He says America didn't come to our country for our sake. America came with a pure Zionist agenda. This is the Speaker of the House of Iraq. And yet most Americans are just blissfully unaware of any of this. Instead, they're believing the big lie, which is out there being promoted by faux news and the Republican Party. It is mind-boggling. My friends, we have an enormous amount of work to do here in waking up the American people. We have got a big job. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Indeed, my friends, and now is the time to stand up and fight. Tom Hartman here with you. 34 minutes past the hour. Program, by the way, brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, and the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECO-WINE for fine organic French wines. I think I was just hearing Veronique say, 2 to 3 glasses of wine a day is good for health. It's in the spot that was just running. Interesting. David, we need to get started here. We need to get healthy. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Before I get to your calls, though, just a couple of quick things here that we will have time to get into in a little more detail as the program goes on. But this from The Independent by Justin Hugler in Delhi. This is a straight news story. This is not a commentary. Satellite photographs of what appears to be a nuclear reactor under construction in Pakistan are the latest evidence that President George Bush's foreign policy is fueling a nuclear arms race in South Asia. Yep, the Pakistanis are now building. They have they're estimated to have around, be somewhere between 30 and 50 uranium bombs, the kind of bombs that we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What they want to start building are plutonium bombs. Plutonium bombs are much more powerful and much more lightweight, much easier to deliver. These are massively more powerful weapons. And apparently the Pakistanis and the Indians are now cranking up to build nuclear weapons. And in large part, this is coming out of the fact that Bush went over there and swapped nuclear technology for mangoes. Remember, Americans are all looking forward to eating Indian mangoes? And put no controls on those technologies. Keep in mind, India and Pakistan, don't just take my word for it. Here's the news story out of The Independent. The border between India and Pakistan remains one of the most dangerous nuclear fault lines in the world. The two countries nearly went to war in 2002, believed by many analysts to be the closest the world has come to nuclear war since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And Bush just making things worse there. Really spooky. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Will at Bailey, Colorado. Hey, Will, what's on your mind today?
Truth teller, how's it going?
I'm great.
I just wanted to say, yay, finally, we're getting the smart people like you to point out the different documents that prove these guys are following the Nazi plan. And the reason they're not upset that things aren't going so terrible as the ones of us that know it is because this is exactly what they wanted. Continuous war, man. Continuous war. It's not their kids or family that's going down. It's ours.
No, and they're making incredible amounts of profit.
Money is all their.
And it weakens democracy. War weakens democracy. I mean, that was James Madison's warning, was that in times of war, the powers of the presidency are increased, and this is a great danger to democracy. Madison went on at some length about it. It's one of the reasons why, when he supervised the writing of the Constitution, they put the sole ability to make war and to pay for war in the hands of the House of Representatives, the group that every 2 years is actually directly elected by the people.
Exactly. And why are we still continually electing these people that are saying right out loud, oh, we're not even going to investigate these Nazis that took over America?
Yeah.
Hey, we ought to have this pretty clear before you even get in office or we vote for you. You're going to put them in jail.
Yeah.
Have a good day.
Well said. Thanks a lot, Will. Good to hear from you. I should say not just the House of Representatives, the Senate as well. Congress together. Storm in Carterville, Illinois. Hey, Storm. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. The people in Europe are still finding dud artillery shells and bombs from World War I and World War II that had mustard and nerve gas agents in them. And also, I'd like to know why, if Saddam Hussein had all those mythical weapons of mass destruction, why did he not use them on our troops?
Yeah, well, obviously because he didn't have them. I mean, it's just incredible that, you know, Fox News would promulgate this thing. You've got all the right-wing bloviators out there hyping it. And Santorum and Hoekstra, in this desperate attempt to get people to buy into the big lie, pushing it. And apparently they're having some success. 14% more Americans now believe that Hussein had weapons of mass destruction than believed it back in February of last year. Up to 50% of Americans now. I mean, I just find that incredible.
It's amazing, Tom.
Yeah, it really is.
One more quick thing. Yesterday,
sure.
You mentioned that you were going to talk about something about Bush, about the latest thing on Bush, and you were going to cover it in your third hour. Unfortunately, I didn't get your third hour. We don't get it here. Is there any way you can briefly capsulize what you were going to cover?
I have to confess, Storm, I don't remember what it is specifically that you're talking about. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'll ask David to, you know, he's right here. He was here then to go over the show. And if we come across something, I'll mention it here.
Well, maybe
in the next
about
hour or so.
The letters that he would write for the preempting himself.
Oh, yeah. The American Bar Association has come out and said that what he's doing is illegal. And Arlen Specter says that he's preparing legislation to try to make illegal what Bush has been doing. I mean,
I think our inspector is a paper tiger, though.
I do, too. He keeps standing up and speaking out and then backing down when the time comes, and it's a real tragedy. But that's I suspect that's what you were talking about. Storm, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening
for a great
to us.
Program, Tom.
You're welcome, and thanks for listening to us there on WINI in Carbondale, Illinois. It's great to have you there. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Will in Lansing, Michigan. Hey, Will.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom. Appreciate it.
Sure, it says here you disagree with me, so you get in front of the line.
Oh, okay. I listen to your show quite often, and I do have to disagree with the comparison from Bush and Hitler about Iraq in general, because I a while ago I printed off this statement after Clinton decided to bomb Iraq in 1998 and gave the address to the American people December 16th, 98, and his end of his statement is saying that Iraqi needs a new regime, and as long as Saddam is in power, we will be deceived, unscum will be deceived, and they need a new regime in Iraq, in Baghdad specifically. His people will live in peace amongst its neighbors and without a different regime change.
So what, Will? I mean, you know, I heard Sean Hannity making the same point a year ago. I mean, so what? Bill Clinton did not send 2,500 American soldiers to their death in Iraq for that doctrine.
How do you expect to do it?
The same way that we have about 100 democracies around the world right now, Will, and the vast majority of them, in fact, I would say with probably three or four exceptions, all of them came about as a result of people within those countries standing up and saying, we want to have a democracy. The main way that you bring about a democracy is you first build a middle class. Without a middle class, you're not going to have a democracy. What you're going to end up with, without a middle class, Will, what you're going to end up with is what you have right now is a radical, you know, radical Islamic bunch rising up and trying to take over.
You can't do it, Tom.
Can't do what?
Once you defy the government, they cut your head off, they cut your tongue out, and they repress you even more. And with sanctions on Iran,
just like it was here in 1770.
It's happening in North Korea.
Oh, I know. It's happening all over the world. Well, I agree with you. There's a lot of terrible regimes out there, and we need to be doing everything we can to support the people who are trying to overthrow those regimes. But when we go in and say, oh, we're going to overthrow your government for you, and then we're going to bring in the American corporations and contractors and let them run your country, and aren't you going to be happy? This is what we get.
This is what we get. I want you to get some Iraqi people on your show, and let's hear it from them, not from you. You're not there. You're not controlling it. You're not making the decision. You're comparing him to Hitler, for God's sakes. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Why is it ridiculous, Will?
I mean, is he gassing Jews? Is he creating an Aryan race? That's why he did that. That's what Saddam was doing.
The point that I was making, Will, is that George W. Bush and his administration, and in particular, and I wasn't even talking about Bush. I was talking about Santorum and Hoekstra from Michigan, that they are using the big lie doctrine. And just right out of Mein Kampf, they are using that. And Americans are buying for it. They're falling for it. Apparently, you're one of the suckers who have bought this line.
Then Clinton used the big lie also. I can read you the statement.
Clinton did not invade Iraq.
Clinton, the hard fact is that as long as Saddam Hussein remains in power, the threat, he threatens the well-being of the people.
And Clinton went to the United Nations, and Clinton got inspectors, in Iraq looking around for weapons of mass destruction, and Clinton got the weapons of mass destruction destroyed, Will. We've had Scott Ritter on this program. We've had other people. Hans Blix, those weapons were destroyed. Are you one of the people, Will? Are you one of the people who drank the Kool-Aid and believed that Saddam Hussein had? Will, you're going to answer this question. Do you believe that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction in Iraq when the United States invaded?
I don't know that for a fact. I give the guy credit. I mean, as far as you're concerned, he could have planted them there. I mean, I give the guy credit for admitting that yes, there was no weapons of mass destruction.
What
were there? I don't know. I mean, there were. They had a number of resolutions with Saddam Hussein.
So you think everything's just working out fine?
No, I didn't say that. I've seen everything's working out fine. But the only way to change the regime is actually change the regime, not sending 400.
No, the only way you change your regime, the only way you can build democracy is from the bottom up. The way that you build democracy is by awakening the people. And the first step to doing that is you help build a middle class among those people. Coming up next, more on the occupation of Iraq, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-440-8466 is the Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Carolyn in Tempe, Arizona. Hey, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Oh, we're live then.
We are.
Oh, okay. I was hearing the gentleman complain that you need to bring Iraqis on your show. Well, we basically brought Iraqis to the United States to give presentations and tell us firsthand, face-to-face, what the situation was in Iraq. And this was just a month or two ago. We brought, and when I say we, Code Pink sponsored this. We raised money, we paid to bring Iraqi women to the United States. They toured the country, went to different cities, one of them being Phoenix, and gave slide presentations, took questions. They were incredibly gracious. I couldn't believe it. And one of them that came here, her name was Iman. And they have posted these women's stories on the Internet if anyone cares to check it out.
Over at codepink.org?
It's codepinkalert.org for the national one, and there's a link on the front page. And what she told us, she is a journalist. She's also a human rights activist, and she's working with the people, the family, Iraqi families, trying to get them to back together with their men that have been imprisoned, hauled off. And she said they have chaos. They have a puppet government. There is no government,
yeah.
Basically. It's total chaos. And she said any time somebody shoots at an American soldier in some area, what happens is they go and they charge into the houses, break the door down, they haul off all the males. And these are just right. People that live there. They didn't fire at them.
Right.
But
we
the Americans.
This news story yesterday in the Associated Press that the several of the soldiers who were involved in one of the atrocities in Iraq have said that they were under orders to kill all military age males, period,
right.
In the area. And in fact, the sergeant and the captain who were in command of them have said, yes, that those were the orders, kill all military-age males.
Right. Not only that, but she said that there are lots of Abu Ghraibs. There are prisons. Yeah. She said mostly that's what's left. There are prisons all over the place.
Yep, yep.
And it's just standard to haul off all the males. And another thing that they were doing, they'd make Iraqis evacuate their houses, and then they would blow them the house up.
Yeah,
and they were just beside themselves. Why do you? They don't understand. Why are you blowing up our house?
Yeah, yeah. And now we have the Speaker of the House of, or the Speaker of the Parliament rather for Iraq.
Right.
Now coming out and saying this, you know, the invasion of Iraq was all a Zionist conspiracy, and that if Iraqis kill American soldiers, they should have statues built to them. This the government that we put up. Bush has done such a marvelous, competent, brilliant job, eh?
Right. And the other thing is she said they had never, ever in their history had a civil war, even
yeah.
though they had the three different factions, at least three different factions within the country. They never had a civil war, and they were intermarried.
Yeah. Well,
and
to some extent, that's the result of what you could refer to as strongman governments, although they did have a democratically elected government up until, what was it, 52 or 54 when... whenever it was that we backed Saddam Hussein and overthrowing him. But in any case...
Well, actually, yeah, another thing she said, you know, what's tragic about this for women is that women were more equal in the Iraqi constitution. They had this secular government.
Mm-hmm.
And women were 50% of the doctors were women. These are
yeah.
educated people.
Yep.
And all we see on TV are barefoot, dirty, you know. They would have us believe that this is a country that was already in the Stone Age. This is not true.
No, we have bombed them back to the Stone Age, and B, virtually the entire middle class and all of the upper middle class and upper class, economically speaking and educationally speaking, have left the country.
Yeah,
they're in Jordan right
now. has.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the other thing that I asked her about, because I read the story, don't know if you remember it, but there was a story back when about the Iraqi police that we put in place found some suspicious characters driving around in a truck or a car that was loaded with explosives. And it turns out that they were British soldiers dressed as Iraqis. And they had all this material for bombs.
Yeah, I remember when that happened. Carolyn, I've got to move along. I appreciate the call, and I encourage people to go over and check out Code Pink. David in Riverdale, Michigan. Hey, David, welcome to the program. We have about a minute left before we have to wrap up this hour.
Hey, Tom, just a quick point on the gentleman from Lansing, Michigan. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to point out...
My hometown, by the way.
Pardon?
My hometown, by the way.
Yeah. This guy needs to think that, if he thinks pro-war for any country, not just Iran or Iraq or any place like that, consider how would you feel if they were coming here?
Yeah.
And if you really want to see how the Iraqi people are thinking and stuff like that, I'm a fan of the Free Speech TV on Dish Network. It's mm-hmm. up in the 9,000 range. I'm not sure of the channel number exactly, but it's FSTV. If you really want to see how the Iraqi people are reacting, go watch that program for a little while. You'll see firsthand.
Yep, well said. David, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it. And good to hear from you there in Michigan. Thank you. In fact, I'll be broadcasting this program live on Friday of this week from Grand Rapids, Michigan, from WTKG, from the studios of WTKG in Grand Rapids, clear channel station there that carries our program, and looking forward to it. And then on Monday night, I'll be up in Seattle. Tuesday, we'll be broadcasting live from Seattle Talk 1090. Monday night, I'll be introducing Bill Clinton and, well, actually emceeing the whole thing, Bill Clinton and Congressman Jim McDermott. In fact, we'll be hearing from Jim McDermott a little later on in the program. It's 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Check our website at www.tomhartmann.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, exposing the con in conservative 6 minutes past the hour. Joining us now is Congressman Jim McDermott of Washington State. Congressman McDermott, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here, Tom.
It's always such a pleasure to talk to you. I probably told you the story before, but I came up to Seattle with my old friend Paul Loeb, who lives there, back just before the Iraq invasion, and you gave a speech at a church there that I attended that was absolutely packed with people, and you were so prescient. I continue to so honor you for your willingness to just speak the truth.
Well, thank you.
Speaking of speak the truth, there's an event coming up Monday in Seattle, this coming Monday in Seattle. You and Bill Clinton are going to be there. I'll be emceeing the thing. And it has to do with to borrow a phrase from Al Gore, an inconvenient truth on this one about Newt Gingrich that you exposed in some regard.
Well, many years ago now, it was 1996, I was the Ethics Committee chairman, and Newt Gingrich was brought before the committee for a series of alleged violations, and I was the ranking member when he was fined $300,000. And made an agreement with the caucus, or with the committee, that he would not reveal what he, or would not try and spin it, really, to control the media. Shortly thereafter, he got on the phone with the whole leadership of the Republican Party.
This was very shortly thereafter.
Very shortly. I don't know exactly what the time frame was, but
a matter
it was,
of a few days or something.
Oh like yes, within a couple days, and. They had a long discussion, and it was taped by some people down in Florida who accidentally picked it up on their police scanner and recorded it. They brought it to Washington and handed it to me, and I gave it to the New York Times. And for my giving it to the New York Times, I was sued by one of the people who was on the line, John Boehner, for invasion of privacy. I mean, that's the issue. Now, from my point of view, it has always been about the public's right to know and my First Amendment right to tell people what I know. If I, as a congressman, if I keep back information like this about the person who's number three in line to succeed the president, I think I'm not doing my job letting my constituents know what's going on. So for me, it was always a people's right to know question.
Well, not just your constituents. You were on the House Ethics Committee at the time. I mean, here's you have a person who has agreed to certain terms to basically not violate the rules of the House any longer, and then you have evidence that he's conspiring to do that with other senior members of the Republican Party. These are my words, not yours, but this seems to me like what happened. Didn't you also have a congressional obligation to at least do something about this?
Well, I certainly, but I really was acting as a member of the public. I mean, I was not doing anything that anyone else did not have a right to do, nor would I. I mean, I would expect people to come forward and let people know when they see something going on. Obviously, whistleblowers have a certain risk, but I do think that it's part of our responsibility is to let one another know what we see in a society. Otherwise, we can't have an informed electorate, which is really what it takes to have a democracy.
Which brings us to the First Amendment dimension of this. The taping of a cell phone call in Florida, it was a crime under Florida law. The couple who taped it pled guilty, paid a fine, and so that was the end of that. You were not involved in the taping of it and didn't know that it was happening at the time and all that sort of thing. So if my understanding of this is correct, if this case is correct, the entire charge leveled against you is that you publicized a private conversation which involved public figures.
Exactly.
And these public figures are asserting that they should have privacy, and you're asserting that the people's right to know, your First Amendment right to free speech, trumps that.
Yes. And here's what the law is. And there was a case called the New York Times case in which they established what gives you your right to publish. First of all, it has to be truthful. Secondly, it has to be of public importance. And third, it has to be received legally. Well, if I were come into your office tomorrow and handed something to you, you have received it legally. You did nothing whatsoever to get it created. You didn't send me out to do it. I just, without any request at all, I appear at your doorstep and hand it to you. That is receiving it legally, which is what happened to me. Now, I obviously don't have a paper or radio station. I handed it to a publisher, and so the court had to look at that issue. Do I have the same right as the New York Times? And the answer is yes. Every American citizen has that right to take something they received legally. If you stole something, that's a different story. Then you have to deal with the legalities of the theft. But in this instance, where it's handed to me without my knowledge of who these people were, where they came from, or how they did it, or anything, I simply was passing it on and under my First Amendment right.
Sort of like, I guess it's an imperfect analogy with Daniel Ellsberg, because I believe he had legal access to the information that he leaked to the New York Times about the Pentagon Papers, but he didn't have the legal right. Or did he? I mean, is there a parallel there?
Well, it is a very similar kind of issue. The government finally decided not to prosecute him. They had a right to prosecute him because he did steal it. But they did not have a right to prevent the New York Times from printing it.
Uh-huh.
And that's how it got into the paper.
And that's the First Amendment portion.
That's the First Amendment part.
So now you receive this information that Newt Gingrich is conspiring to break an agreement. Some would argue break, at the very least, rules, maybe the law. And that other senior Republicans, including John Boehner, are participating with him in this conspiracy. You reveal it to the New York Times. And this was, what, 4 years ago?
No,
it's longer than that.
This happened in January of 1997.
Well, almost 9 years ago.
10 years ago, yes. It's nine years and 9 months or six months, whatever.
So much for my sense of time.
Who's, Who's right. counting, right?
Right. And so now, for all these years, the Republicans have been suing you and pursuing you, and got knocked down, and then a three-judge court said, well, actually, they can sue you. And then the entire nine-judge court has said, no, wait a minute, we're going to look at this again.
Yes, we are in the... We've been in the court. It was thrown out at the first level by Judge Hogan, who's the man who did the case with Judith Miller of the New York Times. He threw it out. Boehner appealed it to the next level. There it was. The judges there said, I didn't have a right. We went to the Supreme Court. There was another case there at the same time, and the court took that one instead of mine and decided in my favor and then said, send this down to the court below to be judged again. They ignored the Supreme Court and sent it back down and said, isn't there some, why don't you see if you can't figure out a way to make this work? And so what happened was it got heard again. At that point, Judge Hogan reversed himself and came out against me. It went up to the three-judge court. They found against me. And so now we're before the whole nine members of the Circuit Court of Appeals in the state or the District of Columbia.
In the first district.
Yes.
So we're speaking with Congressman Jim McDermott of Washington State and principally the Seattle area, but areas thereabouts as well, your congressional district. So, you know, from the outside, I mean, just looking at this as an outsider, this looks to me like punishment. I mean, it reminds me of slap suits, you know, where corporations go after people who stand up and speak out in public meetings about their products or something. This looks like the Republicans are trying to punish you. I'm assuming that you've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in defending yourself, at least.
We've, up to this point, already spent about $400,000-some-odd, and we've got more to go. There's no question that this has been a political vendetta from the beginning. They didn't want me to let out the information that the speaker had conspired to avoid the punishment that the House was putting on him.
Does the fact that John Boehner is now the House Majority Whip, if that's his correct title now, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that he's replaced Tom DeLay. Does that change the political equation to this, or for that matter, the legal equation?
No, one of the fascinating things about this, Tom, is that people often get confused and say, oh, this is just a fight between a couple of congressmen. No, this will remain an issue of the First Amendment and the people's right to know, no matter who is involved in it. And that's why it's worth fighting. People say, well, why didn't you give up or, you know, do something to get out of this or whatever? You can't walk away from something like this when what it means is that you have basically taken away somebody's First Amendment right to tell what they know about a given situation. If we lose the right to know what our government is saying or doing, and you saw that recently. I mean, although this is an old case, it also is very modern because right now you have a case of the New York Times releasing this information about collecting information about money. And people's money. Well, and the government says, oh, you've ruined our attempts to catch the terrorists. Well, people have a right to know what the government is doing in collecting data around their financial affairs.
Yeah, this has to do with the First Amendment. So, which brings us finally back around to Monday night in Seattle. There will be a fundraising event. Or an event that has to do, I guess, peripherally with this. You can find out information about it at McDermott, McDermott4congress.com. And I'll be there. You'll be there. Bill Clinton's
yep.
going to show up.
And Bill Clinton's going to come and talk.
And
I'm really excited about it because here's a man who had his who they went after hammer and tongs for years, and he never backed down. And I think that's the only way you can handle this politically is just to keep fighting.
I wonder if, you know, Bill Clinton would have had the, I mean, if John Boehner's lawsuit against you stands, I mean, if he's successful and it establishes some kind of precedent, could Bill Clinton go back and sue dozens of people for leaking out bits of his past?
That's why it's a can of worms. You know, that's another interesting thing about this. We have an amicus brief, that is Friends of the Court brief, from every major news organization in the United States. They are on my side. Everybody but Fox TV. We've got everybody from the Wall Street Journal to the New York Times and Washington Post and NBC and ABC and CNN. And they all realize if this judgment is found against me, the whole of news gathering in this country will be changed forever.
Yeah.
That's why it's a big case.
This is a big deal. People can find out more about it at McDermott, M-C, D-E-R-M-O-T-T, 4-F-O-R, congress.com. Congressman Jim McDermott, thanks so much for being with us today.
Talk to you again, Tom.
Indeed. I'll see you Monday night.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye. It's 19 minutes past the hour, number 866-440-8466. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartmann.com and click live chat. Telling the truth, the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know about. Tom Hartmann here with you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
I met Dick Cheney for a little chat in California. So sorry that it went for gore. I turned my friends all into billionaires. But now when I come calling, I get shown the door. They say, it's hard to say goodbye, Kelly. We will play golf for many a day. My stock is down, my corporation's aground. I'm only left with my mansion in Houston town. They say, sad to say,
sad to say, oh, Kenley. And we're still curious who knocked you off as you were negotiating for a lighter sentence there. Oh, yeah, that's right. You had a bum ticker. Yeah, yeah, that's right. Ah, that's right. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, our Iraqi Press Availability Senior Correspondent. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Yes, indeed. I'm hot from the Iraqi Press Availability as Prime Minister al-Maliki and President Bush told it like it is, or at least told it anyway.
Now, it's Maliki, not al-Maliki.
Maliki.
Al-Maliki, okay.
Al-Maliki, Nouri al-Maliki, yes.
Now, did he have anything to say about the Speaker of the Parliament, the Iraqi Speaker of the Parliament, calling a news conference this morning and saying, quote, America did not come to our country for our sake. America came with a pure Zionist agenda, end quote.
It didn't come up.
Interesting.
Not a word was spoken about that.
This is just a few hours ago. He also, the Speaker of the Iraqi Parliament, who works hand in glove with Mr. al-Maliki, said, quote, I personally think whoever kills an American soldier in defense of this country should have a statue built for him in that country.
God. I wish I'd known that going in. Not that they would have called on me anyway, but wow.
So how did it go?
Well, it was interesting. They obviously had a full and frank exchange of views. They seem to have agreed on an awful lot of things. When it came to Lebanon, I should think that the temperature in the room fell several degrees. Mm. They obviously didn't agree on that. The questions were quite good. I mean, they were quite well asked. There was one interesting question asked by an Iraqi, which was that, look, you're supplying $30 million in aid to Lebanon, to the displaced people and to help them. And in the meantime, you've expedited the supply of precision bombs to Israelis.
Yes.
Don't you see a kind of contradiction in the fact that you're supplying one side and then supplying the other side? And Mr. Bush's reply was, this is a direct quote, no, I don't see a contradiction.
Well, the United States has a long history of doing that, actually. I mean, and as did the British Empire long before us. It's
indeed.
If one of your major exports is arms, you sell arms to everybody.
Yes, indeed. I think it's just more difficult to get away with it these days. Well, you can still get away with it, but to get away with it unnoticed, but simply because of the kind of press and publicity one gets.
Yeah.
He said that we're honoring commitments that we'd made prior to this, which is true. We'd already made the deal with Israel. I think it's the expedited bit that got to a lot of people when Israel said, hey, look, we need them right now.
Yeah, Yeah, and don't ask why.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, but I'll just tell you why.
There you go. Interesting. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, thanks for showing up on our behalf there with George and Mr. Al Maliki.
Thank you.
Great to have you on, Victoria. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, The True People's Radio.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And to right or wrong, and to weak or strong, it is known to scream from the wall.
And welcome back. 909 days, 11 hours, 24 minutes, 54 seconds until George W. Bush leaves office voluntarily, that is, barring impeachment. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, the Tom Hartman radio program. Our phone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. TomHartman.com. However you spell it, it'll get you there. Boy, if you want to drop into our live chat room or participate in our message board, our blogs, time now for an activism alert.
May take all week and it may take longer. They got the guns, but we got the numbers. Gonna win, yeah, we're taking over. Come on!
Yeah! And, well, here's what we can do. If you don't know what to do, here's a step you can take. Your activism alert for the day. Contact your member of Congress, your member of the House of Representatives of the United States Senate, in particular your two senators, the United States, because the Senate ratifies treaties, although, you know, everybody in Washington will have something to say about this, that has to do with this deal that Bush has cut with India. That allows India, that we're giving India nuclear technology and essentially allows them to use that technology to build nuclear bombs that is fueling this nuclear arms race in South Asia, that is in India and Pakistan. This going back to the story that I shared with you about an hour ago from The Independent, from today, satellite photographs of what appears to be a nuclear reactor under construction in Pakistan are the latest evidence that President George Bush's foreign policy is fueling a nuclear arms race in South Asia. The photographs show a heavy water reactor capable of producing enough plutonium to make 40 to 50 nuclear weapons a year, more than 20 times Pakistan's present existing capacity, according to the U.S.-based Institute for Science and International Security. The new pictures come out just weeks after a former head of Indian intelligence said that a controversial civilian nuclear fuel deal with the U.S. will allow India to produce 50 warheads a year by freeing up its existing fuel for military use. So you get this? Over in Pakistan, they are right now finishing construction on a plant that will make 40 to 50 nukes a year. And last week, the former head of intelligence in India, the head of the Indian equivalent of the CIA, said, isn't this great? When we sign this deal with the United States for nuclear technology, which, of course, the big nuclear companies in the United States, I would assume GE and Halliburton and Bechtel, I'm not sure exactly who they are, but, you know, who build nuclear power plants, big construction, they're just, you know, isn't this going to be wonderful? And, you know, good buddies of the Bush administration all. There was a provision in that treaty that said that India could not say, okay, now that we are getting all this nuclear technology from the United States, the existing nuclear technology that we have cannot be converted into manufacturing weapons. There was a provision in that treaty that said that. It was an amendment to the U.S.-Indian agreement that said India cannot use its nuclear technology to build more nuclear bombs. And the Bush administration, well, to quote Representative Howard Berman, Democrat from California, member of the House of Representatives, he said, quote, "The Bush administration conceded on almost every major point in negotiating this agreement with India. Even worse, the administration essentially ignored the concerns of its own non-proliferation experts and kept Congress in the dark until after the agreement was concluded." So Congressman Howard Berman of California and other legislators are now, as they note over at Think Progress, Joseph Cerencioni blogging this over at thinkprogress.org, he said, Congressman Howard Berman and other legislators are trying to get amendments to the deal that would enable the U.S. to expand cooperation with India without allowing India to go on a nuclear weapons binge. One amendment would require India to halt production of fissile material, the main component needed to make nuclear weapons, in exchange for greater nuclear cooperation with the United States. A second important amendment would prevent India from transferring nuclear enrichment technology to other countries. At the same time, frankly, I would suggest that we have to be urging the administration and urging Congress to urge Pakistan not to build nuclear weapons as well. So, bottom line, contact your member of Congress. 888-355-3588 gets you to the switchboard on Capitol Hill, toll free. 1-888-355-3588. You can find the phone number also on our homepage at tomhartmann.com. And call Congress and call your member of Congress. If you're not sure who it is, just give me your zip code. They'll tell you. And say, you know, this deal with India that allows them to build nukes that the Bush administration just completed needs to be fixed. And we need to be leaning on Pakistan to not be building more nukes as well. And you may want to also contact the office of Congressman Howard Berman of California and tell him good on you for what you're doing. And, you know, if there's anything you can do to help, toss that in as well. 1-888-355-3588, the telephone number. Our phone number here, if you'd like to call us, 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Patricia at Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Quickly, I just wanted to touch on the Israeli-Lebanese conflict. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to discuss was, as far as terrorism is concerned, in order for us to, I don't think we can completely resolve the issue, but diminish the idea of the suicide bombers, we have to try and understand the origins of it. And what I'm speaking to is, as Americans or as Israelis or whatever, wherever you come from, you have to understand the actions of your government. Meaning we have to take responsibility for what our government does. And what I'm speaking to, Tom, is, for example, let me first say that in killing of innocent people, whether you're Arab, whether you're Israeli, I don't care where you're from, is bad altogether. There's no good reason for killing innocent people. But on the Israeli side, what we don't hear in our media is, for example, Mr. Netanyahu, who's a former prime minister, him and his party have been known to talk about the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. Meaning he's so extremist that his ideas have been...
Patricia,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
You know, at the same time that Netanyahu might be saying that, I don't have direct knowledge of that. You have folks like the president of Iran saying that, you know,
exactly.
Israel should be not just ethnically cleansed, but destroyed. So, it doesn't cut much mustard with me. I'm sorry.
Right. But what I'm saying is, you're right, you have that on every end. Exactly. You have that from Arab states. But what I'm saying is that doesn't resolve anybody who has those ideas. The violence perpetuates more violence.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm speaking to is, for example, our actions in Iraq are, you know, as Americans, we like to, you know, fly our flag and put God Bless America in our car. But when we have things like, for example, when we discuss the School of the Americas, we're training death squads in Latin America. And then we say, oh, but we're forming democracies. We have to understand, as citizens, we have to take responsibility to try and understand what our governments are actually doing. For example, what you were just saying in Pakistan and India. You know, let's say we went to Iraq for weapons of mass destruction. We know that wasn't the case. Let's just say, what do we do with India and Pakistan? We're selling the nuclear technology, or we're selling nuclear weapons to countries that have unstable governments. And then 10 years from now, we're going to be fighting the same people because of weapons of mass destruction. I mean, does that make sense? That's what I'm asking Americans to analyze. Does that make sense to you?
Well, thank you, Patricia. No, it doesn't. And you've done a fine job of asking Americans to analyze it. 1-866-440-8466, Charlie in Freeport, Pennsylvania. Hey, Charlie.
Oh, Tom, thank God we got you. Please give me the time to lay this out. But this whole mess over there with Israel, you can lay right at the White House feet. when Sharon was still in power, since 2003, three different times, he told the administration, don't be pushing the Palestinians for elections. Even after Arafat died, don't do it, he said, because Hamas is going to get elected and we won't deal with them, and you know you won't deal with them.
Yeah.
So what did the administration do? They send rice over there, they push for elections, they got elections, Hamas comes in there just like Sharon said what happened. Well, then they're not going to deal with them. Palestinians,
well, and this again is just a classic example of what I was talking about in the first hour of this program, that in order to, and this is what Thomas Jefferson and the founders of this country so well understood, and what the neocons are clueless about, and that is that you can't have a democracy without a middle class. If you have impoverished people and you give them an opportunity to vote, they're going to vote for whoever says, hey, I'll provide you with a hospital, I'll provide you with a school, I'll provide you with food. And in the case of the Palestinian territories, that was Hamas, or Hamas. And in the case of southern Lebanon, that was Hezbollah.
Okay, but please let me finish this because this is very important. I mean,
okay, well, we got 30 seconds here, Charlie. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, anyway, if you remember about a month ago, they had some of them restaurants blow up. They blamed the mosque. They blew up a train or a bus, blamed the mosque. That's when Israel retaliated and killed them innocent kids on the beach over there. So Hamas went in there first, not Hezbollah. Hamas went in there and kidnapped a soldier.
Right.
When Israel retaliated and wiped out a whole block over there and killed I don't know how many families outright.
Yeah.
That's when Hezbollah stepped in and said that you ain't going to do this with our brothers, and then now here we are.
Well, no, I think Hezbollah and Hamas are both, you know, they're united in their anti-Israeli sentiment, but, you know, one's Sunni, one's Shia, they're in different
Correct.
Parts
but
of the
Hezbollah,
world.
Hezbollah has the weapon that yeah. Palestinians don't.
Yeah,
know.
Well, there is that, Charlie. There is that. Thanks a lot for the call. And that's you know, from Israel's point of view, why they feel that they have to take them out. It's just, you know, the question is, are they going to kill or create more terrorists? I think they're creating more. It's 45 minutes past.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Better flag in the bassinet. Downtown hit the floor. What are we fighting for?
Well, I would submit to you right now that what we're fighting for is the profits of multinational defense companies and oil companies, by and large, around the world, and for the political fortunes of the Republican Party. In fact, over in the chat room, Sally 75 says, does anyone know why so many Republicans are supporting the asbestos exposure bill? Yeah, because they're being paid off. It's real simple. Because they're getting money from the big asbestos companies. You know, like Halliburton. I mean, you know, it's just very, very simple. So, anyhow, it's pretty straightforward stuff. Our comment line, if you'd like to call, is 503-323-6620. You want to sound off on an issue of the day, give us your take in 30 seconds or less. Remember, your thoughts and opinions may just make it on the air, so make it count. 503-323-6620. Here's one of our callers from yesterday.
Hi, Tom. Love your show. I'm a libertarian, card-carrying, and I think you express libertarian values better than many of the guests you have on your show that claim to be Randian objectivists. Looking at the government today, it seems like many of these people read 1984 and some of Ayn Rand's works and were inspired by the bad guys in these books and using them as textbooks for how to take power. You see more behavior like Ellsworth Toohey than you see behavior like Howard Roark.
Yeah, it does seem, I agree with that caller, it does seem the times that the Bushies have read 1984 and said, oh, this is a good manual, we'll follow this. Or as I was sharing earlier, the big lie strategy. Hey, we can do that. As regards libertarian, I am not and do not promote libertarianism. Libertarians, in my mind, are Republicans who smoke pot. I mean, that's kind of the bottom line. Here's another one.
Hi, Tom. I think you're mistaken when you say that Bush had to invade Iraq before the inspectors found found that there were no weapons of mass destruction. We had to go into Iraq early so we could get the soldiers out before the hot summer came. And it worked because mission was accomplished about 2 months later.
Well, in fact, he's right. The war did end, or the invasion did end within a month or two. It was successful. Then began the occupation, which has been totally screwed up. Totally.
I just think we should be putting across the challenge and talking point that Republicans cannot win fair elections. We don't have to back it up any more than we already have. It's up to them to prove us wrong. Thank you very much.
And well said. Our calls from the listener line, 503-323-6620. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. If you want to go on live, Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on WTKG, where I'll be broadcasting live on Friday. Hey, Rick.
Republicans are smoke pot. I like that.
Yeah, well, what libertarians are. They're Republicans who think the drug should be decriminalized.
And they like sex and abortion and everything else.
Right. Yeah.
They just don't want to pay higher taxes.
That's right. They smoke pot. They want abortion to be free, and they want to have access to prostitutes. But they're basically Republicans. Yep.
Libertines might be better. But anyway, to get to the issue, I wanted to get away from Middle East a minute here. And you remember when Mr. Gonzalez testified before Congress, and I think he was under sworn testimony, when he pretty much admitted that Mr. Bush had stopped the investigation into his own.
Yes. Gonzalez admitted that Bush prevented the Department of Justice from investigating whether Bush had committed a felony by not allowing them to proceed by cutting off their security clearance. So Bush commits a felony to cover up a felony.
Right. And my question is, and it's pretty much rhetorical, you know, to you and the listeners and to all honest Republicans out there, didn't Mr. Nixon admit something like similar to that on a tape, and that was pretty much the last straw?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, Nixon's statement, in fact, was...
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
That's what Nixon said.
Well, no, I didn't mean that. I mean when he said, he told, I forget who the director of the FBI was, it was pretty much, tell the FBI to back out of this. We don't want them to get...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know what the technical... misprision of a felony or something, maybe?
Yeah, I think that actually came out after he had resigned, but I may be wrong.
Oh, okay, but regardless, though, that's what he was doing. And
yeah.
You're
absolutely right, Rick. You're absolutely right. And,
so
and Bush...
How does Bush, who you know, people said Reagan was the Teflon president, they said Clinton was...
He's getting away... If the question is how is he getting away with it, getting away with it because the media has been cowed because we have a corporate media that is beholden to the same interests that the Bush administration is, and because they don't want to lose access to him. They are terrified of him. And I think that they're hoping that the Democrats will take power in November and maybe, call him to task. But I'm not holding my breath for it. Dave in Eureka, California. Dave, we have about a minute left. It's yours.
Tom, you provide a most valuable service to so many of us. I do want to prevail upon you in your upcoming Michigan get-together there and virtually whenever you have a congressman, and that is to say there is a subject that some think we're not supposed to talk about, but I think we need to talk about it, and I'm talking about rigged elections. I do believe in this country we are being defrauded and badly. And
I agree with you, Dave. And in fact, I think that what Lopez Obrador is doing in Mexico right now is so noble. He's simply demanding that all 41 million votes be counted. What a novel idea.
Yeah, well, wherever you have the opportunity, Tom, you're the guy that's maybe going to have a real role to play in saving this country. If you can get Democratic congressmen motivated, say, what do you know about voting machines? Maybe they're just...
It's not just the voting machines, though, Dave. I mean, go back and read Bobby Kennedy's piece in Rolling Stone. At three-quarters, maybe five-sixths or nine-tenths of the theft of the election in Ohio was not done by electronic voting machines. It was done by old-fashioned fraud.
Bring it out wherever you can, Tom.
Yeah, I will. And you keep two and a two, Dave. I know you're relentless on this, and I appreciate it. Thanks for calling. Good talking with you. 56 minutes past the hour. What are some possible solutions to our educational crisis? After the break, John McNally with America's Report Card will be joining us. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You've been been listening to the Tom Hartman Program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, also known as Portland, Oregon. Broadcasting live from coast to coast. America's Report Card. America's Report Card? An unlikely title for a novel, and yet there it is. John McNally, the author, he's going to be in Portland Thursday, July 27th, in Bellingham, Washington, Tuesday, August 1st, in Seattle at Elliott Bay on Thursday, August 3rd, in Seattle at University Bookstore, August 4th. The Village Books is the August 1st one in Bellingham. And at 23rd Avenue Books here in Portland on this Thursday. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks.
You have written a novel which is, in a way, almost sounds like it can't happen here kind of story. Like, are you crossing that same? I noticed the book is dedicated to Ann Coulter.
Yes. The book grew out of my a job I had in the mid-90s of scoring standardized tests, which was one of the worst jobs I've ever had, and I went into it having a low opinion of the standardized testing industry, and I left with a much lower opinion of the industry as a whole. And you know, with the beginning of No Child Left Behind, I feel that we're not only not trying to solve the problems of the education system, but it's just gotten much worse. And so I began it as an essay back then, but I'd signed a confidentiality agreement, and there was just too much stuff to really put into it. And so about 8 years later, I decided to turn it into a novel. So it's a novel that begins, I think, by – it's a comic novel, I should say. It begins by, making fun of the conservative education reform, but then it kind of broadens to a number of problems that I have with the Bush administration.
It's interesting, and in fact, your previous novel, The Book of Ralph, was very well received. I mean, you're a solid novelist. We're talking about John McNally. In fact, bookofralph.com is your website, isn't it?
Correct.
And so, what in this dystopian world, this No Child Left Behind, post-Patriot Act world where big government and big corporations have essentially merged and become one, what are the challenges that the characters confront in your new novel, America's Report Card?
Well, I think one of it is trying to find a sense of individuality in this world. In a world where, their worst fears are being confirmed. What happens at the beginning of the book is that, one of the characters is scoring standardized tests, and he starts hearing all of these sorts of conspiracy theories and crazy ideas about how the tests are being used and whatnot. And as the book continues on, we find out that all of those things are true. So all of the worst paranoia that you could have come to fruition. And meanwhile, there's a high school student, Janie O'Sullivan, who takes this test and kind of unleashes all of her frustrations on her final standardized test essay. And the other character, Charlie, is the one who scores it and decides that she's in need of help of some kind. And so he goes in search of her to try to become her protector.
Interesting. It sounds like a good, a good setup and a good story. To bring it to the real world,
yeah.
You actually worked in this business. You've seen it from the inside.
Right.
And so let's talk nonfiction here for a moment. What is the state of American education right now? What does standardized testing and No Child Left Behind have to do with the state of democracy? And well, let's start with that.
Well, I think the terrible thing that it does is it divides the nation even further into the haves and the have-nots. I mean, the schools that are going to get punished as a result of not meeting these, you know, preposterous benchmarks are going to be the, you know, typically the schools in the poverty-stricken areas or lower-class areas.
Economically speaking, yeah.
And this whole notion of taking a teacher and putting their feet to the fire and thinking that this is the way that's going to, inspire students to do better on these tests, when in fact, you know, they have, you know, a plethora of other problems to deal with. I grew up in a sort of lower middle class Chicago suburb and was a first generation college student, so, I mean, I know that, you know, I could have cared less about taking these standardized tests, and there really wasn't much that, you know, when you look around and you see, you know, people working for minimum wage or just scraping by, I think what happens is, what needs to happen is, I think, a sort of a closer look at the community that these schools are in, and I think the government needs to invest in improving people's lots and lives.
To what extent... John McNally, author of America's Report Card, bookofralph.com, the website. To what extent, John McNally, would you suggest in the real world today, not so much in the world of your novel,
right,
that standardized testing is being used as a tool to actually destroy the middle class in the United States or control it?
Well,
is that hyperbolic to suggest?
I'd like to think that it is, although I'm not sure that it's really hard to say. I mean, I'm not sure that I'm not sure what the intent is in terms of, you know, other than saying, look, the Bush administration says, look, you know, we're gonna prove that we're gonna make education better.
Yeah.
Back
when Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party over the No Child Left Behind law, I mean, that was the straw that broke the camel's back for him. And I lived in Vermont at the time, and I was working on a book called Unequal Protection, a nonfiction book about the rise of corporate dominance in the United States. And I met with some of the people on his staff in his office, and they shared with me, and it's in my book, a research report that was done. There's a research arm of Congress that does research for members of Congress that's like not for the public. Like you and I can't go to them and say, would you please look into this, but they can. And there was this internal research that was done by this nonpartisan congressional group at Jim Jeffords' request, I believe, that came up with this basically 100 and some odd page document that I read through. And the bottom line summary of it was that used to be in public schools that the way teachers did tests is they would come up with them themselves, or they'd, you know, use them, take them out of the textbook, copy them on the Mimeo machine. They cost a penny a piece for the, you know, the cost of the paper and the Mimeo whatever, you know, or the copy machine, and no big deal, no profit center. And there was a roughly $300 million a year industry, a testing industry in the United States that existed before the No Child Left Behind Act. And it was mostly for standardized tests like the SAT and things like that. That testing industry was very much in bed with a number of very powerful Republicans, and that industry wanted to get very rich very fast. And they knew that if they could sell intellectual property, that is, you know, ephemeral stuff, paper, you know, words on paper, the stuff that you and I sell when we write books.
Right.
If they could sell that at an inflated price, if those tests that those teachers are passing out to students, instead of costing 2 or 3 cents from the Mimeo machine, could cost $8 or $10 a student, then great money could be made. And they estimated in this study that the first 2 years of implementation of the No Child Left Behind Act would cause this $300 million a year industry to become a $1 billion a year industry.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it has. And, in fact, George Bush's brother, Neil, is in that industry.
Right.
You know, he's running a testing business. So there's a clear economic motive. I mean, it's clear that there were people bought off and people have become multimillionaires as a consequence of No Child Left Behind. But are there deeper and more insidious social consequences to it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that there are definitely deeper consequences to it. Again, I'm not sure exactly, you know, what the motives of the people are, you know, in terms of what in terms of dividing, you know, the haves and the have-nots of this country. Mm-hmm. But
well, they say, you know, if a school doesn't meet the quotas, they start losing funding. So
right, and then they could privatize the school.
Right, exactly. So the schools are doing badly are going to do even worse, and then, you know, it's the old, hey, break government, and then say, hey, look at it, it's broken.
Right.
So that's happening.
My first really eye-opening experience was working for standardized testing when I saw that, once you have this multi-million-dollar or billion-dollar industry involved in this, that what they want to do is, I mean, they want to keep their contracts. And
right.
So one of the ludicrous things that I end up putting in the novel is this whole idea that we weren't scoring necessarily for accuracy, we were scoring for consistency. And by that, what I mean is that the government needed to see that we were scoring the same test. The test that we're scoring today was scored the same way 4 years ago, even if it was misscored 4 years ago.
Amazing. Anyhow, the novel is America's Report Card. John McNally, he's also author of the Book of Ralph, bookofralph.com for more information. John, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Every breath you take, every call you make, every bite of steak, for our nation's sake, we'll be watching you.
Oh, it's Mr. Gonzalez's song.
Every single day. We'll check your dossier. We see where you pray, what you buy, what you pay, because we're watching you. Oh, can't you see? It's called security. You've got to trust us too, because we don't trust you. On us your life depends. We wanna know your friends. We won't make amends. Our means have noble ends, and we'll be watching you.
Indeed, watching you all the time. 22 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And time now to check in on how things are going with the occupation of Iraq.
I wanna know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the cannon. And there is blood on the wire.
These are the developments in Iraq over the last 24 hours, as reported by Reuters. The bodies of two people were found with gunshot wounds near Fallujah. In Sakhalilowye, the U.S. military killed two civilians on Monday after a roadside bomb exploded near their patrol. In Baghdad, the final death toll from an explosion and clashes which erupted between gunmen and police on Monday on Haifa Street in central Baghdad is 4 policemen killed and 36 wounded, according to the Interior Ministry. In Mosul, gunmen set fire to food ration stores run by the Ministry of Trade. At midnight in the northern city of Mosul, near Kirkuk, a gunman fired rocket-propelled grenades at two fuel trucks, killing two drivers and abducting the third on the main road between Kirkuk and Baghdad. One of the trucks was set on fire. In Dakhuk, gunmen wounded 4 people working for a private Iraqi company which deals with the U.S. military. In Baghdad, a policeman was killed and 3 wounded when a roadside bomb went off near their patrol in the Zayouna district of the capital. In Baghdad, gunmen killed a policeman in a drive-by shooting in southwestern Baghdad, police said. In Mosul, 3 Iraqi soldiers were wounded when a roadside bomb went off near a joint Iraqi-U.S. patrol. In Ishiki, a gunman killed a police officer while he headed to work near that town. And near Baqaba, the bodies of 5 people were found shot dead on Monday night in a village near Baqaba. And in Diwania, gunmen killed a former member of Saddam Hussein's ousted Ba'ath party on Monday. In that city, 112 miles south of Baghdad. In addition to this, the Speaker of the Parliament. This is the Parliament's the Speaker of Parliament for the country of Iraq. As al-Maliki is meeting with President Bush right now as the Prime Minister, the Speaker of Parliament, arguably a more powerful person, frankly, last weekend described our occupation of Iraq as butcher's work, which led Josh Bolton, White House Chief of Staff and collector of photographs of George W. Bush's hands, Josh Bolton, led him to the Sunday talk shows where he said that he'd actually talked with the House Speaker and Mahmoud al-Mashhadani, And Mashhadani had said he appreciates the sacrifice so many Americans have made. Well, he apparently doesn't appreciate it that much because today he held a press conference and he made 2 points. He said, number one, I personally think whoever kills an American soldier in defense of this country should have a statue built for him. And secondly, he said, America didn't come to the country for our sake. America came with a pure Zionist agenda. That the news from Iraq. Andrew Patrick Cockburn in Amman, by the way, reporting for The Independent of the UK. Headline, sectarian breakup of Iraq is now inevitable, admit officials. Iraq as a political project is finished, a senior government official is quoted as saying, adding the parties have moved to Plan B. He said that the Shia, Sunni, and Kurdish parties are now looking at ways to divide Iraq between them and to decide the future of Baghdad, where there is a mixed population. He says there's serious talk of even Baghdad being divided into Shia East and Sunni West. Mr. Maliki, hang on just a second here. Don't ever, if you do radio, don't ever eat peanuts during the break. Mr. Maliki, who said he is increasingly isolated, has failed to prevent the violence. Other Iraqi leaders claim he lacks experience in dealing with security, is personally very isolated without a kitchen cabinet, as it were, and is highly dependent on 30 to 40 Americans in unofficial advisory positions around him. He's, of course, meeting with George W. Bush right now. Mahmoud Othman, a veteran Iraqi politician, said the government is all in the green zone, just like the previous one, and they have left the streets to the terrorists. And again, an Iraqi politician referring to the people who would refer to them as nationalists, as terrorists. I think from the point of view of an American soldier, certainly they're terrorists. From the point of view of the average Iraqi, though, when you've got polls showing somewhere between 80 and 90% of Iraqis agree with the Speaker of Iraq's parliament that anybody who kills an American should have a statue built to them. Things are not going well. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour, exposing the con and conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program. 1-866-440-8466-440-THOM, our telephone number, toll free all across the United States. And Jack in Orange County, New York on the line. Hey, Jack, welcome to the program.
Yes, my point is that you have to bring more troops to Iraq because it's a disaster right now in Iraq. They have to you leave it empty on some troops and other provinces in Al-Anbar. They will bring in all the troops to Baghdad. And you can't leave the Iraqi troops alone because they are Shiites. They will kill all Sunnis.
Here's an interchange between Dick Morris and Bill O'Reilly on Bill O'Reilly's program the other night. First of all, Dick Morris back in March said, no possibility that a civil war is going to happen in Iraq. We've got everything under control. We have a successful occupation going on. Now, yesterday, this is what Dick Morris said.
But, you know, in Iraq, the casualties are dropping. The U.S. casualties
are dropping. Right, civilian, yeah. Because it's now a civil war.
Exactly.
After Zarqawi was killed,
what we don't
the insurgency
understand.
Fell down.
What What we don't understand is in Iraq, a civil war is progress. It's no longer a war against us.
A civil war is progress in Iraq because it's no longer a war against us. Jack, this is how the right-wing American commentators are talking about this now. They're basically saying, to hell with the people of Iraq. If they're going to kill each other, that's fine with us as long as they're not shooting at us.
Yes, it's correct that it's a civil war right now, but it will be more dangerous, it will be worse if you leave the Iraqi troops alone, because they're Shiites and they killed...
Because the Shia militia have infiltrated the military or have simply become the military?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't disagree with that analysis. Sending more U.S. troops to Iraq, though, wouldn't it be better to do what Bill Clinton did in the former Yugoslavia, which was, you know, had been cobbled together out of several states after World War One, very much like Iraq was, out of, you know, cobbled together out of three former states from the Ottoman Empire after World War One, and break them back up again and say, okay, we're going to have a bunch of separate countries here. We're going to have Bosnia and Serbia and Croatia and like that. We're going to have Shia land, Sunni land, and Kurdistan.
It's a bad decision if you separate it from Iraq. This will be Turkey, then to Lebanon.
Turkey will go nuts if Kurdistan becomes independent, but,
yeah.
You know, hey, what are they going to do? I mean, they're going to have their own problem with their Kurds, you know, in the north, northeast of Turkey, I guess it would be. You know, Turkey's objections, I don't think, have ever stopped us in the past, have they?
I think that America will bring back Saddam Hussein because they have right now a war. It will be a war with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And Iran is Shia, and the only man who fought it with Iran was Saddam Hussein.
So
we have no problem with it.
So you're suggesting that our best option is to put Saddam Hussein back into power?
Maybe.
Interesting. What, Jack, if you don't mind, your accent isn't typical Midwestern American. Are you from that region?
Yes.
What do you base your observations on?
What?
You know, what do you base your observations on? Are you Iraqi? Did you used to live in Iraq?
No, I didn't live in Iraq.
I see. Okay. Well, it's interesting. I don't have an easy answer for this thing. You say we should put more American troops in there, but the American troops just, you know, the experience indicates that American troops are an irritant. They're just, you know, in addition to being targets to shoot at, they're viewed by Iraqis, and this is pretty universal. I mean, here we have the Speaker of Parliament coming out today. They're viewed by Iraqis as agents of some sort of Zionist conspiracy on the one hand, or as agents of the oil companies and on the other. In any case, not viewed as anybody who's there to help them. Why would more American troops do anything other than just cause more polarization of the situation? Or you're saying that we need to protect the Sunnis?
Yes.
Okay, so
the Sunnis are the modest ones,
right? Yeah, I understand this, and the Sunnis are the ones who
are extremists.
Yeah, and that, well, relatively speaking, I mean, if Osama bin Laden is a Sunni, but what's his name, the guy that we just killed recently, was a Sunni, but the Sunnis by and large have been the secularists. They've been the ones who've been saying that it should be a secular state, and the Shia are the ones who are following the Iranian routine and saying let's make an.
He sent a lot of weapons to Saddam Hussein in the 80s.
Yeah.
Now that I'm soaked, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, interesting. Interesting. Very well, you know, very
thoughtful. Don't have a problem with Saddam Hussein.
You don't have a problem with Saddam Hussein?
Did Donald Rumsfeld send weapons, dangerous weapons?
Oh, he was our guy, Saddam Hussein. We put him in power.
Yes.
Yeah, he was our guy. He was there to protect, you know, to hold back the spread of Shia theocracy coming out of Iran. And prevent that from, you know, prevent the Shia crescent from forming, you know, arcing across the northern part of the Middle East there.
And we send weapons to Iran, too.
Yeah.
And countries.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a mess. Jack, thanks for the call, and I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Sure. What we get back down to is that there's no easy answers here. Man, there's just no easy answers, which is what we were all saying to George W. Bush in 2000, the fall of 2002. I so remember you heard the interview earlier in the program where I was talking with Congressman Jim McDermott. And by the way, McDermott for Congress, don't put Jim in there, just McDermott for Congress.com is the website if you want to have if you want to get some tickets to go to the gig that I'll be emceeing Monday night in Seattle with Jim McDermott and Bill Clinton. And I remember sitting in that church a couple of months before the invasion and listening to Jim McDermott tell the story of having just come back from Iraq and saying, hey, you know, I was there. This is not about weapons of mass destruction. And if we go in there, we're going to make things so much worse. It's going to be a terrible situation. And he was so right. And he was one of the few voices in Congress who were willing to speak up and speak the truth. And just the largest demonstrations in the history of the world, the largest outpouring of people in the history of the world, were people all over the world going out into the streets in the fall of 2000, in the winter of 2000, asking George W. Bush not to invade Iraq. But he had to take back the Senate. He had to have his war so he could have some political mojo. And his friends in the oil industry had to make sure that the Iraqi oil was under control because, hey, Saddam might actually sell a whole bunch of it and lower the price even further. Keep in mind, oil was selling for $18 a barrel when we invaded Iraq. You lock up the Iraqi oil just about the time that you're hitting peak oil, and you can do a pretty good job of getting oil up to $70 a barrel in a hurry, and then everybody's making a whole lot of money, everybody in the oil industry. Not to mention, the weapons manufacturers are doing well. The private military people are doing well. Halliburton is doing well. The American construction companies. After all, there's no more construction jobs in the United States. So we'll go over and we'll rebuild Iraq. That'll work. Mike in Fair Oaks, Pennsylvania. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hello, how are you today, Tom? Thanks for a great show.
Thank you.
July 11th, the Wall Street Journal had an editorial titled A Nuclear Japan. And in line with what you were talking about Pakistan and India, the Wall Street Journal in this editorial says that it will only take a matter of weeks or days for Japan to go nuclear.
Right.
It's this Korean situation that is forcing the issue. In fact, this will probably create an armed Japan. It's inevitable.
Well, we already have an armed Japan. They call it the Defense Force, but they've got one of the more muscular militaries in the region now.
Yeah, 243,000 men under arms. There were 600 of them in Iraq. First time they'd been in combat, actual combat since the Second World War.
Yeah.
And this editorial states that.
And by the way, there's a big movement inside Japan to amend their constitution to say that they, because their constitution right now says that their military can only be used for defensive purposes.
It speaks of the Article 9 constitutional amendment. They've upgraded their defense agency to a full-fledged cabinet status, and they are behind the U.S., Russia, and China. They've spent more on defense than any other country in the world, according to this Wall Street Journal editorial.
Right.
That is really a major concern to me. And what the Bush administration may be doing with Japan and for Japan also concerns me.
It seems to me, Mike, that what we're seeing right now is a confluence of events that's not that dissimilar to what we saw just before World War One. And you've got all these countries with these interlocking, you know, mutual defense treaties. And you've got a whole bunch of international arms brokers, a weapons industry that wants to make some serious money and sees that coming. You've got countries who are jockeying for influence in various regions, now by and large over oil, but jockeying for influence. And you've got a mindset that says that war is not just a reasonable solution to all problems, but the most effective solution to all problems. And, you know, Europe learned from the lesson of World War One and World War Two. Europe has become essentially pacifistic, but the United States did not. And Bush clearly did not. I mean, you know, he didn't want to serve in Vietnam. Nobody in the Bush family wants to actually be in a war, but, you know, supporting war. Yeah, cool. And these guys are all running around talking about World War Three. I think it's because they're trying to create it.
Well, I served in Vietnam and I served with Koreans,
mm-hmm.
Rock Marines. And I can tell you this, I don't see any difference between a North Korean and a South Korean.
No.
But as warriors, they are unbelievably insane.
Ferocious warriors. Yeah, interesting. Mike, thanks for the call. And ultimately, where we have to get to in the world, but particularly in the United States, is where we say, I don't see any difference in any people. 45 minutes past the hour.
is the Tom Hartman Program.
You better think, think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go back, let's go back, let's go way on the way back when. I didn't even know you, you couldn't have been too much more than 10.
Welcome back. Yes, thanks, my friends. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass destruction. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, you got to think. In fact, we're still wondering. You know, there's here we have the Speaker of the Parliament in Iraq coming out and saying that a statue should be built to any Iraqi who has killed an American soldier. The Speaker of the Parliament. Today. And There are serious analysts, you know, careful, thoughtful folks who look at military situations who are suggesting that one of the major problems that we have in Iraq is the fact that we privatized the war. We sent in, it's the second largest army in Iraq is not the British Army. The second largest army in Iraq is private contract. We call them private contract. We used to call them mercenaries. They're carrying guns. They are licensed to kill. They are theoretically answerable to the justice system of Iraq, but in fact not. The people of Fallujah were so enraged by their behavior that not only did they kill them, but they mutilated their bodies and hung one of them from a bridge, which led to our basically taking out Fallujah. You've got somewhere between 10 and 30,000 private contractors, that is to say, mercenary military, in Iraq. And they do not operate under the rules of war. They do not have to follow the Geneva Convention. They are not answerable to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And they're not answerable to American law. And they're not answerable to Iraqi law. And we're still waiting to hear the answer to that question that was asked back on April 10th of this year by a freshman college student of George W. Bush.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's an honor to have you here.
Thanks.
I'm a first-year student in South Asia Studies. My question is in regards to private military contractors. The Uniform Code of Military Justice does not apply to these contractors in Iraq. I asked your Secretary of Defense a couple months ago what law governs their actions. Mr.
I'm going to ask him. Go ahead. Help.
Well, I was hoping your answer might be a little more specific. Mr. Rumsfeld answered that Iraq has its own domestic laws, which he assumed applied to those private military contractors. However, Iraq is clearly not currently capable of enforcing its laws, much less against, you know, over our American military contractors. I would submit to you that in this case, this is one case that privatization is not a solution. Mm. Now, Mr. President, how do you propose to bring private military contractors under a system of law?
Yeah, I appreciate that very much. I wasn't kidding. I'd pick up the phone and say, Mr. Secretary, I got an interesting question. This is what delegation, I don't mean to be dodging the question, although it's kind of convenient in this case, but never. I really will. I'm going to call the secretary and say, you brought up a very valid question, and what are we doing about it? That's how I work. Thanks.
I'm the delegator, yeah. See, this is what you get when you have a privatized war. We privatized the electric grid in Iraq, and it doesn't work. You know, we're privatizing the oil industry in Iraq. It doesn't work. We're privatizing all across Iraq. We're privatizing. It doesn't work. Just like privatizing many things in the United States doesn't work. Now, again, I'm not somebody who thinks that every industry, or even most industries, or even a small percentage of industries, for that matter, should be owned by the government. Doesn't, you know, no. No, I'm all in favor of capitalism and free enterprise. But those functions that should rightly be done by government, and we need to acknowledge that they're there, those functions that should rightly be done by government must be done by government. And back when Gerry Ford was president, and he made Dick Cheney his chief of staff,
And Dick Cheney suggested that they commission Halliburton to do a study of how they could privatize functions in the U.S. military under the rubric of increasing efficiency and decreasing costs. And Halliburton did a study and said, well, very simple, just start hiring us. And then I interviewed on this program a woman whose son was killed because he was traveling the road between Baghdad and the airport to get his mail because Halliburton was responsible for delivering the mail, and they had decided that week that the road was just too dangerous. So the soldiers had to go out to the airport and get their own damn mail. And her son died going to get his mail because the private post office, as it were, the private mail delivery company said, we're not going to do that. Halliburton giving water to our soldiers that was contaminated with fecal matter. Halliburton giving food to our soldiers that was in terrible shape, that was contaminated. I mean, we used to do these things ourselves. Remember KP duty? Well, you haven't been in the military, but whether you have or not, everybody knows a KP, you know, a kitchen police, right? It's peeling potatoes? No, we don't do it anymore. We outsource that. Used to be, you know, some grunt earning the equivalent of $12,000-$14,000 a year, whatever starting pay is in the military, was the guy peeling. No, now it's a Halliburton contractor making $150,000 a year. It doesn't work. And outsourcing, we tried to outsource this war, we're trying to outsource the occupation, and now the people that we're trying to outsource it to inside Iraq are saying that statues should be built to anybody who shoots at us. I mean, this is the brilliance of the Bush administration, right? This is they tried their neoconservative ideas, and they have destroyed another country. That's at, you know, 25 years after they started destroying this country in which we live. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be calming down conservative David Tebow, who is outraged that Democratic senators want to block congressional salary increases until the minimum wage is raised by $2 an hour. Remember, my friends, activism starts with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.